This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Kelvin Yee. Today, we're going to focus our conversation on populism, specifically populism in the European Union. Populism has made its splash in every election in the West lately, from the US to the Netherlands, and more recently France, where centrist and pro-EU Emmanuel Macron is now president. But there was some concern that his opponent, anti-EU and far-right populist Marine Le Pen, would have won. What is it about populism that has made it so dominant in Western politics of late? I wanted to find out, so I spoke to Matteo Garavoglia. He is a non-resident fellow at the Center on United States and Europe, the Brookings Institution. Matteo, it's a big sigh of relief for those who are in support of the EU that Emmanuel Macron is now president. But how concerning is it that an extreme right-wing party, Marine Le Pen's party, managed to return to mainstream politics in France after so long?
Actually, I wouldn't say that they've returned to mainstream politics. I think the Front National has been in mainstream politics at the very least since 2002. I mean, in 2002, that's when Marine Le Pen's father managed to get to the second round of the French presidential elections. He didn't become French president, but since then, the Front National has been a constant presence in French political life. So in that respect, I wouldn't say it's a return to mainstream. They've been there for a long time. Now, is this concerning? Yes, it is. But I think that the main reason why the Front National and the fact that the Front National is doing well is reason for concern. It's not really just for the policies that they promote, which we might agree or disagree with, but it has to do with the fact that they are proponents of a European French brand of populism, and that is always concerning because populism is about ignoring facts, ignoring data to the benefit of rhetoric, and in that respect we should be concerned because they are here to stay.
You know, I just wonder if populism looks and sounds the same in every country. Could you talk about the characteristics, say, between the difference in Europe and also the difference in the US, for example?
There are underlying traits for when it comes to populism, and then there are some national variations. It's a bit like cooking in that respect. Well, let me see. First of all, you know, what is populism in that respect? Populism is a mode of communication. It's a way of framing public discourse whereby the key principle is one that sees us as we, the many, the simple people, the common people, the masses, against them, the privileged, the powerful, the few, the wealthy elites. And it frames most political discourse along this narrative, so to speak. That is something that we see across the world and also in Europe. European countries have different political histories, but we do see some slight variations when we look at the Netherlands or France, Germany, Italy. You can see some variations, but this narrative stays there. Now, who, you know, when, where, and how does populism resonate with the public? Well, we do know that there are certain socio-demographic groups that somehow are a bit more likely to click, to tune in when populist discourses play out. We know that populist discourse is more effective in addressing individuals that come from a low socio-demographic group. So when it comes to low levels of education, low income, also tendentially more from rural areas rather than urban centers and older members of the population rather than the youngest ones. But having said that, populism goes beyond. And, you know, this is the hardcore socio-demographic group, if you want, with which populism tends to resonate, but it goes beyond these groups for sure.
And why do you think it resonates with these groups in particular? What is the pull factor of populism?
Well, I would say that the issue with populism exists everywhere in all political systems, democracies and non-democracies across Europe, the Western world, and beyond. It's always there. It's always a part of political life. It resonates. It clicks. It works. It becomes more apparent when the political establishment and the political system fail to deliver certain goods. when unemployment goes up, when people cannot get a job, when there's endemic corruption and citizens see a political elite or political class taking advantage of their own privileges, when social services do not deliver what they're meant to deliver and people feel they pay taxes but get nothing in return, that's when populism can do well. So that is something that we should keep in mind. It's always there. Populism, though, manages to emerge and take over public discourse when our societies fail to deliver certain goods for citizens.
I guess another thing that's common in populist rhetoric is its anti-globalization. They say that it isn't beneficial and that it has taken a lot of opportunities away from the people in a certain nation. How true is that?
Well, there is some truth to that. I would never claim that globalization is good for everyone and benefits everyone. There are winners and losers, like in almost everything else. So what we do know is that we see that today certain countries benefit more than others from globalization. Certain economic sectors within different countries, certain sectors of the economy, benefit more than other economic sectors. And certain individuals benefit more than others, those individuals that have the tools to take advantage of the opportunities that globalization brings, also in economic terms, will benefit. Well, those that lack those tools will be hit hard, first of all, in terms of employment opportunities.
How can we then say that globalization is beneficial? Because then that's the message of a lot of those who are in support of the EU. How can we sell that idea?
I think maybe I would question your assumption. I wouldn't say that those that are in support of the EU are in favor of globalization as such. I think it's the discourse is far more nuanced there. I would think that there is actually a significant body of both of evidence as well as of public support that will be ready to acknowledge that globalization is a mixed bag. It comes with advantages and disadvantages, and that the issue is how to maximize the advantages for the greatest number of citizens and minimize the disadvantages that this entails. Now, when you connect this to the whole issue of the support or lack of for the process of European integration and the European Union, well, we see there some interesting public discourses emerging. For instance, there are those that claim that the European Union is a vehicle of globalization, that it's a tool, that it's a machine that fosters and nature globalization, and that therefore we should, break down this machine. We should withdraw back into the nation state and be protected and sheltered by the nation state. On the other hand, there are those that would say that because the forces of globalization are massive and no single nation state is able to handle them properly, to manage them, that we should use the European Union as a tool to manage globalization, to take advantage of the opportunities that globalization brings, while at the same time shielding citizens from the worst collateral damages and negative impacts that globalization brings. So you have two different narratives that look at the European Union either as a threat or as a form of protection when it comes to globalization.
I'm speaking to Matteo Garavoglia from the Brookings Institution about populism in the EU. A lot of populism deals with identity, us versus them, friend or foe. How do EU citizens identify themselves? Are they EU first, nation first, or a confusing mix of the two? Matteo tells me after this. You're listening to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Be free-minded. BFM 89.9.
You're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Kelvin Yee. Today, I'm speaking to Matteo Garavoglia from the Brookings Institution about populism in the EU. A lot of messages and rhetoric from populists involve identity, the identity of its people and nation. Take Trump's Make America Great Again, or even Britain's Empire 2.0. Could you help me understand how citizens within the EU view themselves? Do they view themselves as a bloc, or are they EU first, nation first, or do they somehow integrate the two?
Indeed. Traditionally, the whole discourse, public discourse on issues such as globalization and so on has been framed in economic terms. But I think that is a flawed way to look at it. And we have plenty of evidence suggesting that individual citizens increasingly go to vote and perceive public life in terms of identity rather than in economic terms. How European citizens view themselves, well, it's a difficult question. I would say that, first and foremost, the average European citizen still perceives of her or his own identity through the lenses, through the perspective of the nation state. That is still the bedrock of most individuals' identity. Having said that, I would say that probably there's a sizable chunk of Europeans that also would see themselves as a second step, in second place, also as Europeans. So not that they wouldn't perceive the whole issue of European integration as an either-or, where we are either citizens of a nation-state or Europeans, but rather as citizens of a nation-state in the first place, and in second place, also Europeans. This is now particularly the case among certain socio-demographic groups. We know that overall, young people, very well-educated people, people in urban centers, as well as individuals with higher available disposable income, tend to be the most, pro-European in that respect. By all means, I'm not claiming that that is the case outright, and there is variation between countries and other socio-demographic groups that also will be supportive of the process of European integration. But this is the socio-demographic group that is the most favorable to the process of European integration, and that would view themselves as both members of a country, but also as Europeans.
Going on about the messages, they are also stark generalizations. You know, it's us and them, or these people are either friends or foe. Populists often present complex issues that require complex solutions as simple issues with simple solutions. You know, if we just look at the immigration and refugee issue, for example, why do you think people are inclined to these sort of messages?
I think it's human nature. When people are scared, people want reassurance. When the economy doesn't go well, when unemployment is high, when people cannot get jobs, when people struggle to find out how to interact with somebody from a different culture, religion, from a different ethnic background, when people feel insecure, where they feel that they are not managing change, they seek for reassurance, they look for reassurance. And popular discourse in that respect comes in very handy. It gives us a very brush, quick answer, or in theory, it proposes a solution to very simplistic solutions to actually to problems that are very complex, very difficult to handle, and that require very long-term work. So I think that is, in that respect, is basic human nature. I'm not surprised in the least.
How widespread is that fear of the other in the EU? Is it even in each country, or does it happen more so in countries that have taken in more refugees lately, like, say, Germany and some parts of France as well?
No, I think it's the whole issue is rather more complex than that. Indeed, when we look at the data, we see that there is no clear causal mechanism or direct strong correlation between the number of migrants in one place and racism, or the other way around, and so on. The data is extremely contradictory in that respect. There are actually interesting things, though, that we observe. For instance, we know that in a number of countries, discourses, opinion that seems to be rather xenophobe or racist, are much more prevalent in areas that see very few immigrants living in. Usually, it's odd, but we see more racism and xenophobia in different parts of different countries where there are very few immigrants, very few foreigners. What we know, however, is that rather than the amount of, for instance, foreigners that are present in a certain country, region, or city, what seems to be upsetting or individuals or causing challenges, rather than the absolute number of individuals of a foreign background or foreign origin, what seems to be challenging is the speed at which foreigners come into a community. So that is to say, to give you a practical example, we have relatively few instances of xenophobia and racism in a city like London, where, you know, coming from a different ethnic background and different religions and different skin colors have been mixing and, merging with each other for decades, if not centuries. and where there's a very high proportion of individuals coming from a non-traditional British background, then in some parts of rural England that see very few foreigners in absolute terms, but I have seen, crucially, over the last 2, 3, 5, 10 years, a very quick increase in the number of people from a different ethnic, religious, or social cultural background.
Right, and I guess there were a lot of concerns that parties representing populist values would win in elections, for example, the Dutch, the French, and the Austrian elections. Is it just a play up by the media? Is populism really as widespread as we think as it is?
Well, I should be cautious what I say about the media when I talk to the media. let's put it like that. No, populism is a real phenomenon, and it's there, and I believe it's there to stay. But in itself, I'm not concerned about populism in itself, in the sense that it is part of political life. It has been there for centuries, and it will always be there, I believe. The question is how well our political system will manage to provide answers, how resilient our democracies here in Europe will be when it comes to providing answers, because populism feeds itself on what I believe are some genuine concerns. There are challenges, and we should not brush aside the criticism and the complaints that come from many sectors of the population as mad. It's not that everybody is suggesting that there are problems in terms of multiculturalism, integration, finding jobs and so on, is a right-wing, nutcase, racist person. That would be disrespectful to this to these people. There are some significant problems. Unemployment, challenges in terms of having different cultures working together, corruption, the quality of our democratic system, representation, privileges. These are genuine problems. And what is crucial now is that while it is, in my view, good that populist parties have failed and actually have done remarkably poorly in countries such as France, Netherlands, and Austria lately, what it is crucial is that our societies and our political system deliver answers to these genuine problems. This is the only way to keep populism under control on the medium to long term. Otherwise, we'll be back there soon.
We're heading for the news, but after this, Matteo and I talk about the future of the EU. Will it survive, or will we head into a future without it? You're listening to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Banish fraudulent maneuvers, BFM 89.9.
You're listening to the Evening Edition, and I'm Kelvin Yee. We're talking about populism in the European Union. Today, we're speaking to Matteo Garavaglia. He is a non-resident fellow at the Center on the United States and Europe, the Brookings Institution. We know that populism has been in European politics for a really long time and will continue to have its presence there in the near future. EU leaders now have the opportunity to address the social problems like unemployment and income inequality that feel support for populism. With the current political climate, though, will the leaders be able to stop populism in its tracks?
I actually think so. I'm an optimist by nature, but I do think there are good opportunities out there. I think we should never waste a crisis, and crises always breed opportunities in themselves. Let me give you a couple of examples. What we saw over 2016, over the last 12 months, has been some seismic changes. We had the election of Donald Trump in the United States, and the follow-up, his policymaking, that is something that has concentrated minds in Europe. A lot of Europeans feel that Europe cannot and should not rely anymore on the United States, but that Europeans have to stand on their own legs in terms of foreign affairs and in terms of taking charge of their own destiny. Brexit, at the same time, has been a blow, has been a shock for many people in Europe, but again, possibly an opportunity. The United Kingdom has been a country that systematically, continuously over the years has frustrated any attempts that other European governments have made to boost cooperation amongst European countries in a variety of policy areas. Now that the UK has de facto isolated itself and cut itself out of the game in Europe, this will provide an opportunity for other European countries to finally move forward. And of course, a resurgent Russia in the East, as well as what we see as an increasing authoritarian system emerging in Turkey, these all help to concentrate minds in Europe. Finally, there's two positive developments that we see. One, we see a situation whereby we could soon have in key European countries governments that are fundamentally ready to reform, to move forward, to integrate, to cooperate. Emmanuel Macron in France, but either Angela Merkel or Martin Schulz, whoever will win the elections in Germany, are extremely pro-European in that respect. The government that will emerge in the Netherlands will most likely be along those lines. Spain traditionally had a pro-European attitude. The question might be in Italy. So in terms of political establishment, there might be room to move forward in terms of European integration, cooperation, and reform. This is from the top-bottom, but also the bottom-up matters. What we saw was a reaction over the last few months. Whilst the media picked up very quickly on populist movements, xenophobic movements, racism, right-wing movements, and rightly so, what I've seen emerging over the last few months all across Europe is the opposite. Grassroots movements, civil society movements of primarily young, urban, well-educated individuals across Europe that are starting to take to the streets to speak up. To speak up in favor of Europe, asking for more Europe, more integration, more cooperation amongst European countries. And that gives me reason for hope.
The G7 summit just happened over the weekend and Trump basically bashed the NATO nations. And Angela Merkel has come out to say that EU will have to direct a lot of its own courses. And on the ground, you say that locally, there has been a lot of political participation. Are people in EU ready to be more politically active on the global stage? Will they take on more global issues and challenge them?
I do think so. I think in that respect, the political elites are lagging behind people. I think there is a vast body, socio-demographic group across Europe, across countries, especially young, well-educated Europeans that are extremely politically engaged and willing to engage with the world and so on, very much so. And they are asking to the political establishment to do the same, to engage and to move forward working together as Europeans. My hope and what I think we might be seeing in 2017 could be the year where the political elites across Europe heed this call from European citizens and start to move forward by working together as Europeans.
I know it's hard for you to say because in general, it's hard to say that there's a general consensus to want to get into it. Do you think there is a general consensus or is it just an urban push towards joining these activities?
No, there is. Of course, there are fault lines. Not for a second I would claim that all Europeans are on board in something like that. No, I think what we experience is part of a broader shift. Traditionally, political life, at least in Europe over the last decades, actually I would say the last 200 years, has taken place along an x-axis. On the one hand, you had the left, on the other hand, you had the right. You had the worker on the one hand, and on the other hand, you had the owner of capital. That was a traditional center-left, center-right divide. And that's where political life took place for many years. What we're seeing now is a shift from an x-axis to a y-axis, whereby on the top of the y-axis, you have forces that are fundamentally open, progressive, liberal, cosmopolitan. And on the bottom of the y-axis, you have forces that are fundamentally closed, nationalist, xenophobic, closing down on themselves. This is the new axis where an historical battle in terms of ideas and values will take place. And I think this is what we'll be seeing playing out in the years to come. The forces at the bottom of the y-axis, the more xenophobic, nationalist, racist, populists that have been in the lead over the last couple of years. Now what I do see is an awakening of those forces on top of the y-axis in terms of citizens and civic engagement, ready to speak up and try to reclaim public discourse. So that is a battle to be played out.
And is this battle solely in the hands of Macron and Merkel, you think?
No, not at all. Not at all. Paris and Berlin are crucial, of course. You go nowhere in Europe without Paris and Berlin on board. But there are other countries that are crucial that need to be brought in. One big question is how to handle, Italy and Spain. They are massive countries that play a big role in Europe. They will have to be brought on board, Italy and Spain, for sure. And this, you know, when you say Macron and Merkel, of course, that's a political establishment. But civil society will have to keep speaking up, being loud, in order to nudge, to push the political establishment in this direction. So no, it will go beyond Macron and Merkel. They are sine qua non. You cannot do without France and Germany, but they're not enough.
The German elections will happen very close to the third quarter of the year. Could you talk about how that might play out and how that might affect the future of the EU?
Yes, I mean, what we are likely to have, I believe, is, you know, Angela Merkel is now ahead of the poll in the polls. She might well win again and be in for a fourth term. So in that respect, it would be, you know, a smooth transition, a new government, but stability. We would know what to expect. What I see there is a shift in the sense that with Emmanuel Macron in France and so on, Merkel is increasingly signaling a willingness to put, you know, to push forward more and be more assertive when it comes to European integration, working together, European cooperation, and reforming a number of policy areas with a very strong pan-European perspective. Where, on the other hand, Martin Schulz to win the elections and the Social Democrats to win the elections, I would say I would expect pretty much the same. Martin Schulz is extremely pro-European, and so are the Social Democrats. So no matter what, I would expect after the federal elections in Germany on the 24th of September, for Germany to push on the accelerator when it comes to further reforms and European integration.
And finally, could you just look into the crystal ball and see how bright or how bleak the future of the EU is?
I think there's all the potential for it to be bright. A lot will depend on the next 12 months, because if, as I said, I'm not terribly concerned about the German elections. The key issue will be the Italian elections, I believe. They will be in the fall of this year or at the beginning of 2018. There are at least three parties that vie for supremacy: the Social Democrats, the Partito Democratico, the center-left, fundamentally, the traditional conservatives with Silvio Berlusconi, and the Five Star Movement, which is pretty much a populist movement. Italy will be key, because Italy is the third largest economy within the Eurozone after Germany and France, and how things will play out in Italy will be crucial to either bring stability and an opportunity for Europe really to move forward and get out of the crisis that has been in for the last 10 years, or to keep the whole of Europe hostage of a potential Italian crisis, both political and financial and economic, that could spread to the whole of Europe. So I'm optimistic, but I would rather look at the crystal ball the day after the Italian elections.
Dr. Matteo, it's been such a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you for spending your time with me.
Thank you very much. My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
I've been speaking to Matteo Garavoglia. He is a non-resident fellow at the Center on the United States and Europe, the Brookings Institution. If you know someone who wants to learn more about politics in Europe, they can get up to speed by listening to this show. Get them to download the podcast on the BFM app, available for iPhone and Android. You're listening to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.